Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies brought to you with the support of the ICON Research Center at the University of Warwick. And welcome to Season 3, Episode 23 respectively, where we begin covering the 8 JMS classics, starting with a super interesting paper on strategy featuring one of the authors, a very special guest, Mike Rice. My name is Dimitris, coming to you from Birmingham in the United Kingdom.
This is Ralph, coming to you from Albuquerque, New Mexico in the United States.
And I'm Mike Wright, coming to you from between Nottingham and Derby in the UK.
So you're on the road.
Well, I live between Nottingham and Derby. I'm at Imperial, but I commute there.
Right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. This is really amazing, and we're super happy to have you contribute to this initiative that we have with the Journal of Management Studies.
If you're unfamiliar with who Mike is, he's a professor of entrepreneurship at Imperial College London, and he's a prolific author, having written over 40 books and more than, I think, 300 papers, which is quite incredible, in all sorts of journals. He served as two terms as an editor of Entrepreneurship Theory and Practice, and was also a joint editor of the JMS, the Journal of Management Studies, that we're collaborating with here. And we're super excited to have him.
So the papers we are going to look at, there's actually three of them, but the main one is a paper by Mike and three other people, Robert Hoskison, Igor Filatichev, and Mike Peng, called Emerging Multinationals from Mid-Range Economies, the Influence of Institutions and Factor Markets. And you can find links to the readings on our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com, where you can go and look at this amazing stuff. So shall we summarize the work briefly before going into it?
Yes, the paper is an update and extension of an earlier work that the authors did in 2005, that was in a special issue of the journal. And what they are looking at is analyzing emerging and multinational corporations along a framework that they use that includes two dimensions: institutional development and infrastructure and factor market developments. And in the paper, they go into detail explaining what they mean by those two dimensions, and the paper is used to do a bit of a retrospective on things that have occurred in the field since the 2005 paper was written. So it's an interesting update of that, as well as the paper uses this topology as a means of suggesting promising and interesting research questions that should be pursued along four topics or areas of study. And those four are government influence, resource orchestration, market entry, and corporate governance regarding the internationalization strategy of the emerging multinationals in these mid-range economies. And it's a interesting grouping of the countries. They go into detail in the paper about how they grouped the countries and what the factors were that they looked at, and then they talk about the implications of the groupings. They give many examples of economies and areas where the companies have struggled and some have done well. And they use those as an illustration of the points they make, where they illustrate things that we ought to know more about. And that's essentially what the paper focuses on. Is it's a the guiding question of the research is, what's the most significant development in strategy research and practice in emerging economies that has crucial importance in the literature? So for other researchers, it's this goldmine of opportunities and ideas of things to go research.
Right. And I think one of the significant concluding remarks was that, especially with regards to the subject matter, was that the strong separation of things like emerging or traditional or developed economies is maybe a bit not quite as relevant now as it maybe may have been. And there's a lot of stuff in between, and how that relates to everything that Ralph said.
Right. That's one of the things they emphasize multiple times, is that there's a heterogeneity of emerging economies that often, when you take this broad brush and just refer to emerging economies or emerging multinationals, you're missing a lot of the really interesting and important details that would expand our understanding of what helps these companies or what retards their development.
Yeah, that sounds a good summary.
Lovely. So I guess I'd like to ask a couple of general questions up front before we go into specifically, and we'll be asking everyone this for the season. So why did you choose to write both of these papers?
Well, I guess the simple answer for the 2013 paper is because we were asked to. So let me put it all in context, starting with that paper. JMS, as you'll know from the issue in which it's published, it was published in the 50th volume of JMS. And as part of the celebration of the 50th year, the then editors decided to set in motion this classic series, taking a paper from each of the decades of JMS's publication life. So for the, obviously ours was the latest one. So it was really taking the paper, the 2005 paper, and saying, well, this is a very highly cited paper in that decade. And also it's a bit unusual because that was an introduction to a special issue rather than it being a completely freestanding paper. So they wanted, so A, it's highly cited, and B, it was in the latest decade, and they wanted us to build on that. So if I can then go back, wind the clock back a bit, both these papers you need to see as either a culmination or a stage in the development of a long research program. And I think is interesting to note that these things don't just come from nowhere. Myself and Igor Filatychev had been working on emerging markets. Well, we've been working on it since the early 90s. As you gather from Igor's name, he is Russian, or was Russian. We started working on that in the 90s and published a lot of work. And we hooked up with Bob Hoskisson in the mid-90s, looking at Russia. And from that work, we then developed the special issue in Academy of Management Journal that appeared in 2000. So Bob and I and two other people were the editors of the special issue, and Igor had a paper in the special issue. So we were building the momentum, and we saw there was a lot of work on strategy in emerging markets. So subsequent to that, we decided that as the agenda was developing, then we wanted to revisit some of the things we said in the 2000 special issue in the 2005 special issue, because by then emerging markets transition was developing. More countries were going through transition and more countries were emerging. And some of the issues to do with the kind of conceptual approaches that we had anticipated might develop in that 2000 paper, maybe they were changing. So that was the kind of the pitch of the 2005 special issue, about challenging the conventional wisdom as things were changing, and that's interesting in itself, because again, if there's a clue in the name of emerging markets that they're changing, there's something developmental about them. So we need to think about how these things are changing over time. So we worked on the special issue, published several papers in the special issue, and then the 2005 paper was setting those papers in context. And what I like to do, or what we like to do when we do a special issue, is actually to write a front-end paper that is a full-length paper that sets out a framework of analysis and then fits within that the papers in the special issue, which then identifies some of the gaps in that framework that need to be areas for further research. And that's what we did in the 2005 paper. So we're looking at movements from developed to emerging economies to emerging economies to developed economies, and so on, and looking at how some of the conceptual approaches like transaction costs and so on were changing, and that institutional approaches, institutional theory approaches, were actually becoming more sustained at that time than we had anticipated in the 2000 special issue. So that kind of contributed to the agenda in 2005. And I think that then gathered a lot of citations as people saw some of the areas for research that we were identifying. So then to come back to the 2013 paper, then as I said, that because of the this classics series, and because that got a lot of notification and a lot of citations, got well over 1,000 citations. The 2005 paper, the 2000 paper has about 2,800, I think. So because he was well cited, then we wanted to revisit. So, you know, as academics, if you get invited to write a paper for a good journal, you don't say no.
So, that makes sense to me.
Yeah. So that was good. But it's also, what's nice is it gives you an opportunity to say something different from what you would say in a regular paper. So, that's good, and it's also quite a challenge. I think we're all trained through PhD and beyond to write particular sorts of papers, and I think some people find it very difficult to write, let's say, a position piece or a standing back piece of work. But if you can do it, I think that's quite a fun thing to do. So that's really where we came from for that paper, which I'm going to more detail. But the author of the authors. I took the lead on the first paper in 2005. So we tend to have a rule that whoever starts the first draft becomes first author and is responsible for shepherding the paper along. And then in the second paper, Bob Hoskinson started the first draft, so he went first, and then I came in second. And then obviously, rather than just kind of summarising where the paper had come to, we actually had to try and come up with a different framework, something new. I mean, the companion paper in the issue of 2013 by Dean Zhu and Klaus Mayer, that was one that was more looking at how that paper had an impact in more detail. So they look more at that. We face the challenge of what is it we're going to say that's different. And that's how we then started to frame the paper.
Right. So I guess when you were starting initially, you weren't really satisfied with the traditional categorization of Michael Porter and the varieties of capitalism, of clustering different kinds of national economies in the way that they normally are, such as, you know, the developed and the developing. And yeah. I'm just curious how you arrived at this problematization. So why did you decide that it's more dynamic than that, and that it ought to be explored?
Well, I think because from the research we were doing over this long period of time, which by the time the 2013 paper arrived, that we've been, Igor and I had been working on the area for 20 years, so we'd started to see that these markets were evolving, evolving at different paces. So that started us thinking, well, how do we get a handle on this, to take an agenda forward? Because if we just took a static view, then we could be missing a lot of the interesting insights and challenges to the development of these emerging markets. So then that was one thing. And then the other thing was that as we came to appreciate that, as I mentioned, institutional theory was more long-lasting, shall we say, than we perhaps initially anticipated, then we began to recognize that some of these institutional dimensions, institutional constraints broadly defined, were impacting on the way in which these markets were developing. In other words, they weren't just disappearing and suddenly there was this transfer to a market economy. There were certain other dimensions in there that were restricting that, which perhaps researchers and policy people hadn't fully appreciated back in the late 80s and early 90s.
Yeah, it's certainly something that I was always curious about while I was both studying and teaching things like international business and other related subjects, is that this line between one type and the other type, and surely it's not binary, that as you just pointed out, that a national economy doesn't switch from coordinated to or centrally planned to a liberal market, overnight, essentially. So I really enjoyed both all three of these works, especially for my personal theoretical inclinations. I really enjoyed reading about these four theoretical orientations that are permeated in the literature: the transactional cost theory, the actor theory, the resource-based view, and the institutional theory that you sort of surveyed in the 2005 paper. That was really cool.
We had that some of that in the 2000 paper, so we were revisiting some of the way those conceptual approaches had developed or had been used in work that had evolved since that 2000 paper.
Yeah, and you mentioned that the institutional theory sort of developed much stronger and further than you had anticipated before. Yeah. Why do you think that might be?
Well, I think it's because, I think that's two things. I think, on the one hand, I think it started to become clear, or people start to realize and appreciate that this kind of smooth transition from central planning or an underdeveloped economy to a market economy wasn't happening. And so one had to say, well, why isn't this happening? And I think that's when people started to look at the nature of the institutional context and not just say the difference between a developed and emerging economy institutional context, but to look more in a fine-grained way at the dimensions of institutional context. I think what also was influential, and partly why Mike Peng is on the paper, I mean, Mike Peng had a paper in the AMJ special issue in 2000, and I was the editor on that paper. He, in the meantime, had published a pretty influential AMR paper in 2003 on institutional theory applied to emerging economies. So I think that had also influenced or started to influence the way research was going in this area. It's also worth mentioning that, bearing in mind that in the economics area, then a lot of work was being done on emerging markets, and that was starting to look at different indices of institutional context and so on. And that's something we kind of cross over those areas. Some of the original work that Igor and I did in the early 90s was published in economics journals before we started to publish much more in strategy and IB journals.
And you can definitely see this crossing over, and I think that's very insightful from all of you. For instance, you suggest that these four approaches that we just talked about, they're not mutually exclusive, and rather that one helps develop the rest. That, for example, you wrote that the institutional view helps extend the resource-based theory, and that the transaction cost the perspective helps understand the actor theory. And I think that's great, because it's not a mutually exclusive typology of four approaches that don't communicate. It's rather curious. Can you maybe give an example of when one or more of these can enrich the other one, so by way of communicating between these approaches?
Well, for me, the important juxtaposition or interaction is with institutional theory and the other theories, really, because there's this notion of perhaps a resource base and other theories as being kind of universalistic in different contexts. Whereas if you then interact with institutional theory, there, or institutional dimensions, then you start to get potential insights as to how different resources or transaction costs may differ according to the particular dimensions of a particular institutional context. You know, so different resources may be more useful, more feasible, and so on in different contexts. And if you think about transaction costs, then you know there's a work on institutional voids, which again talks about what happens to the insights we get from transaction cost theory applied to developed economies when you have an economy or economies where you've got institutional voids like India and so on. The work of people like Kana and Palapu, their work on institutional voids. So things like that are where it becomes particularly interesting, I think.
I wanted to explore a bit the role of organizations within all this, because one of the things with the institutional theory, which I generally enjoy but don't really use that much, is because it doesn't, I think, give due attention to the importance of individuals, or specifically the consequences of activities of individuals. And while I guess maybe talking about the role of individual people within the context of national economies is not entirely meaningful, what about organizations? What do you think? How much weight do organizational actions carry in shaping these different categories of economies?
Well, I guess maybe it's a two-way street, but I look at some of the work. A lot of the work I do is on entrepreneurship, and so there's quite a lot of work now on differences in entrepreneurship across countries, and that's a lot of that is down to differences in institutional rules of the game and so on that influence not just whether entrepreneurship takes place, but the format or the form in which entrepreneurship takes place. And I think you could extend that to perhaps to organizations generally.
It's still a general idea that the framework within which these activities occur is almost prescribed by these macro factors, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to be a bit careful in how you deal with it. But what we were trying to get at was, if you just take an institutional macro institutional factors being developed versus emerging economy, that's far too crude. What we're trying to say, well, if let's look at the more fine-grained dimensions of the institutional context. Which of those dimensions, and again, it depends on, there are different views. I mean, there's the kind of the North view, which is more economics-based, the Scott base, which is more sociological-based view of institutions. There, and then there's kind of the whole stuff on formal and informal institutions. Some of the work I've done subsequently on entrepreneurial ecosystems in research policy. In 2014, we did a special issue. These are all getting into a more fine-grained way of looking at institutional context, and that helps then perhaps to us to start to get at a more insightful way of looking at how those dimensions of institutional context influence organizational and entrepreneurial behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's still quite a lot more work to do on that. But I think it then becomes, you start, I think, to get closer being able to make those causal links or better associations rather than being too black box, if you like.
Yeah.
Well, it looked like that's what you were doing in the research questions, right? Where you were taking these broad areas and then you were breaking them down into details such as what's the role of government intervention or the regulatory structure. So it looks like that's what you were doing as you were posing those questions.
Yeah, I mean, obviously in that kind of paper, then the research questions are relatively high level. Obviously, we haven't got the space to set things out in too great a detail, though we did quite a lot in there. That's the way we're trying to push people to think about these things, and hopefully that would then spark ideas and interest amongst folks generally. There is besides the stuff we've done in that, there is an emerging, I'm going to talk about entrepreneurship again because that's one of the most, there's a whole emerging agenda in the entrepreneurship area about the role of context, institutional context, well, not just institutional context, but organizational context, social context, geographical context, temporal context, and so on. That this black box is being opened of context to try and help people to think a bit more carefully, and obviously that raises further research questions for people working in this area. So I think things have moved. I increasingly like to see things in terms of context rather than just institutional context, because I think it becomes clear that institutional context, whilst interesting, is a bit too macro, a bit too high level. There are other dimensions of context that may be important, and that's some of the things we've been doing when we look at entrepreneurial ecosystems.
All right, what do you mean by context? And I don't mean to be Socratic on you, but since
I think for me it's coming down to this notion of if we're trying to get universalistic or generalizable insights or conclusions from our research, or using theories that are constructs are generalizable in all contexts, the problem then becomes, well, what happens when you look at in contexts other than, let's say, the US or the UK, and you find that some of these things don't hold, some of these relationships don't hold. Now, how do you explain that? What I'm trying to say is, well, actually, if you then look at a different context in terms of whether you measure that by institution or organization or whatever, is there something about the characteristics of those contexts that lead us to expect that the relationships would be different? And then we can get more interesting hypotheses that say, well, in such and such a context, we expect the relationship to be like this rather than like that in a developed economy context. So this becomes important. So as an, if I put my editor's hat on, as an editor, I get a lot of papers. So I edit stuff on corporate governance, for example. So you get a lot of work on corporate governance that looks at the role of boards or non-executive directors in the US context, look at that relationship with performance. And then you get papers that, let's say, come from China or India or something, and they just test the same hypothesized relationship in China or India without really saying, well, actually, there may be something about the Chinese context that would lead us to expect this relationship to be different because, you know, it's a one-party state country, the rules of the game are different, board members may be appointed for different reasons by the state rather than by shareholders, and therefore the role of non-execs might be different. So that's where you start to open up much more interesting hypotheses and empirical studies that enable you to think about the boundary conditions of explicability of theories developed in the US and the UK in these other contexts.
Would you say that the context issue should also extend to the key concepts such as strategy, that, for instance, understanding of strategy in the West may be different from understanding strategy in the East or South or elsewhere?
Well, I think so. Or at the very least, we need to think about in what context does the West apply, results from the West apply, and in what context doesn't it? I mean, there's a whole broader contingency theory literature that goes back to the 70s and 80s, which kind of looks at organizational control, a lot of it, look at the context or the contingencies, it called it. So there's some of that literature. One of the problems I think about is, okay, and this is where my economics training comes out, is, well, what's the dependent variable? Ultimately, the dependent variable for me is performance. You know, so it's kind of the so what question. Do these different relationships matter in terms of the performance, or do you still get the same answer? So I think it's kind of looking at the extent to which these different contextual factors influence the way organizations behave. What's then the impact on performance? Do they perform in the same way, or do they perform better or worse?
Isn't this a descriptive activity, that describing the different contexts and the different approaches to whether it's the institutional perspective or the transaction cost or whatever? Empirically, does that even matter to people who are engaged in setting strategy and working within those settings that we generalize?
On one level, it's descriptive, but really you're trying to tease out what are the different conceptual constructs from that context, which then lead you to expect different relationships. So it then becomes a theoretical device. Which then, if you then work that through, then that might suggest that if you're moving on to practitioner arguments, then it might suggest that, well, our insights from the US and the UK may suggest that for strategy you do X, whereas if you actually look at context Y, then actually doing what you would do in the developed economy is just not going to work because there may be institutional constraints and so on. So for example, if you take the Kahner and Palapu stuff on institutional void, there you have got some interesting insights. And I think I mean, they had papers in Journal of Finance and AMJ, but they also had a Harvard Business Review paper showing that some of the arguments for divisionalized conglomerates and all this kind of stuff were actually undermined in a situation of institutional void. So you could be in a situation where your insights from a developed economy may need to be turned on their head if you go into a different context. That's why it becomes important.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the trick, I think, in positioning papers increasingly, I think.
Yeah. Shall we talk a bit about your typology of emerging economies that Ralph outlined in the introduction, where there is two axes, the institutional development and infrastructure and factor market development. Would you maybe like to outline a bit what this typology is about? And
yeah, well, this is, the typology is a device to try and get a handle on, it's an expositional device to try and get a handle on this variety in the stage of development of these emerging economies. So a strategy, folks, we like 2x2 matrices. So as an expositional device. So
it's a good format, isn't it?
Yeah. If we'd use more variables, then it obviously gets more complicated. But these seem to us to be particularly useful devices that we could draw from the literature.
It clearly wasn't sufficient for you, because there's a category jump right in the middle as well.
Yes, I noticed that actually. I was going to ask about that when you go over the topology. I'm curious about that. You could maybe draw a diagonal line from the high market factors and institutions.
Well, you can see the diagonal line running from top left to bottom right.
Yes. I was wondering if you could comment on that, or what, if you think there's any additional insight in that.
Well, I think what it means is that there are, again, there's heterogeneity in these different emerging economies, but the certain combinations of these factors could still mean that these are mid-range emerging. So mid-range isn't about this is the only configuration of those factors. There are different configurations on that diagonal that says that these are mid-range. They're in some kind of midway stage, if you like, in moving from the traditional emerging economy through to a more newly developed economy. I think as an expositional device, we started with the four quadrants because that's easy to explain. What then happened, if I just kind of sideways for a minute, what actually happened between the first version of this paper and the revised version that got accepted is that the editors said to us, it's all very interesting, but why don't you actually put some figures to this? And they said, well, you know, because in the 2000s special issue introduction, we actually listed the 64 emerging economies, and people cite that and use them. And here they said, well, the paper would get more traction if you actually showed some data on which countries fit within each of these categories. And so that's where you get on table two. Well, table one is the cluster scores, but table two is actually the scores in relation to institutional infrastructure. And then in figure two, we get the cluster plot of these economies. So the idea was that as we analysed it, this one in the middle started to emerge. And that's why you get these categories within the within figure two. But the idea was we actually spent a lot of time collecting the extra data on each of those countries and then conducting the cluster analysis to position them in these different quadrants. So that the idea then was kind of a conceptual discussion around figure one. And then the later stuff was meant to be more empirical to kind of say, well, okay, that's the conceptual idea. What does it look like on the ground? And then by providing table two, we were hoping that people would actually cite the paper by using those fine-grained measures, those fine-grained scores in future work in this area.
So one of the, Mike, one of the questions I had about figure two, because I think it was very helpful to show this, that it shows that diversity now. You can actually see it as it is across the dimensions in figure two, is that you see the groupings. Groups 1 and 5 are pretty straightforward, right? Because you're talking lower side of the chart, upper right-hand side of the chart. And then I see the groupings you did for clusters 2, 3, and 4. Yeah. And then if you look in the middle and you see there's quite a few there that are kind of at the boundaries of 2, 3, and 4. And was that a challenge for you in your analysis to say, okay, well, where do these things fit in which of these clusters?
Yes, it was. And I think that's kind of reflects that going back to what you said earlier, this is kind of reflection of this kind of moving target that we're looking at. And even though we're saying, well, we need to think about the dynamics of these economies, this is actually just taking a snapshot at a little point in time as to where these economies have gotten to. So you've still got some this closeness and intermingledness when it comes out, but that's the way. When we actually ran the cluster analysis, that's the cluster analysis was then putting them into these five clusters.
Right. Was that surprising to you? That kind of diversity in the middle of the graph, would you find it surprising when you ran the cluster analysis?
I think we're perhaps surprised that, on the one hand, perhaps we were surprised initially, and I guess there's a lot going on amongst all those communities, a lot of countries.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. In fact, I wonder what it would look like if you did the graph, the same kind of analysis, 5 years hence or 10 years hence, or some number like that.
That's one of the interesting things. Maybe one of the research areas is, you know, how does this then evolve further?
Absolutely.
Which of these have moved in which direction? Because what it doesn't tell you on that figure two is, you know, which direction are these guys headed?
What I was just thinking about, that looking at it almost seems that it's exploding in every which way, right? At the same time, might be gravitating towards Latvia and Egypt.
Yeah, you wonder. So. Yeah. Well, and also I wondered when I looked at this, I wonder if I came across to the authors, do you think there are cultural issues associated here? You kind of talk about countries from one emerging multinational going into kind of neighbors and neighboring countries and some issues associated with that are promising lines of research. But as a kind of cultural, having a cultural interest myself, you know, I wonder, you see some clusters of Latin American and Central American countries, you know, some of those kinds of things. And you think about the clusters of, in the Far East, perhaps. Was that something that that you thought about when you were doing this cluster?
As I say, I think we're trying to, for expositional purposes, we're trying to simplify things by taking these particular dimensions. I think if we try to bring in culture and so on, then that would have added other insights, but it would have made the story more complicated for what we're trying to achieve.
Oh, I understand. Yeah, I wasn't criticizing the lack of culture being included. It is just...
Yeah, so that's why we weren't dismissing, but yes, culture. But then I think you then need to say, this is where the interaction between the different elements of context become important, in the sense of, if you take Latin America, I don't know much about Latin America, and if you take Latin America, you might say, would you say that there's a similar culture, but... You might say, well, there's also different institutional contexts within Latin America.
Right, right.
So how do you actually trade off those? And if you look at Asia, for example, you could say, okay, there's a quote unquote, an Asian culture, whatever that means. But you have some countries in Asia have got a kind of a British governance code.
Yes.
Some have got Germanic, some have got so on and so forth. So you know, you start to interact these contexts, then you start to get different insights. So I think that's really what we're trying to do. Paper was to say, well, we know this isn't the full story, but hey, think about this heterogeneity, because it then starts to give you new insights, and then subsequent research can take that forward with culture and religion, if you like, even, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. So you were talking about the kind of promising research directions to go from here. And I was wondering, the paper was written or published in 2013. And so we're maybe 3 years later from that. Are you starting to see a lot of people going down some of these paths, or did it generate the interest that you had hoped it would in research?
Well, it's getting a lot of sites. So
that's a start.
Maybe we've not seen as many people using those scores that we set out. But there are other World Bank measures around, and other measures that people are using. So I think there is growing recognition of this this need to look at a more fine grained heterogeneity. I think the other thing is also research is starting to use more time variant measures as well. So you need access to World Bank indices or whatever that are time variant as well. So to recognise that these things are changing over time. I think we are starting to see that. People like Saul Estrin and colleagues in entrepreneurship are using fairly sophisticated time variance. I think Doug Cumming is in the kind of the venture capital area and so on. The basic idea, I think we're starting to see coming through now. And I think if you do work in this area, increasingly reviewers are starting to say, well, why haven't you got time variant institutional indices and stuff like that?
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Is it just time, or is it also local variance?
The local variance you'll get in terms of country by country, but there's also growing interest in the kind of regional variation within countries.
For the same reason, I'm actually happy that you didn't include culture within the...
Well, so am I. It wouldn't have fit. I agree.
No, I think this generalized national culture thing of Hofstede and others is rapidly losing purchase these days.
Yeah. I agree. It's a bit of a stretch given all the communication vehicles we have and international travel and those kinds of things. I think
there's that on the one hand, which kind of, you would say, diminishes national cultural differences, but at the same time, there is a recognition of that there are sustained regional differences within countries. So if you've got a huge country like China or India, the cultures are quite different to different areas. So we did a GIBS paper looking at some of that, and there are one or two other papers in it, strategy and GIBS looking at these regional differences within.
Regional differences in China, which is still quite poorly connected to the global markets, would be different than, for example, the Netherlands or some more connected place where there's more expats and foreign students and generally more immigration and emigration going around. I don't know, would they still display a strong internal distinctions? I mean, in a way meaningful to strategic research, obviously.
I think so. I mean, because, you know, you know, there are different institutional infrastructure. I mean, even if you look in the UK, you know, you've got the notion of the Northern powerhouse, the notion that there are institutional issues in the north of England, different from the south of England, and that affects the way in which business is done, businesses are created and so on. In the north of England compared to the south, and so policy has been trying to be developed to change some of those things. Similarly, if you go to China, then you know there is big differences between whether you're in not just Hong Kong, but if you're in Shanghai or Guangzhou or whatever, Zhejiang, where you've got very advanced corporate and entrepreneurial infrastructure and behaviour compared to, let's say, some of the far west in China. So there are these differences, even though it's supposedly all under the communist system, there are these differences in the way in which things work.
It sounded like at your opening description that not only is it this the kind of offer you don't refuse when you get invited to submit a paper like this, but it sounded like you actually enjoyed this opportunity to go back and look at the paper and rethink and reconceptualize some of the ideas. Is that a fair summation of your attitude toward the paper?
Yeah. Oh, yes. I mean, it was actually pretty challenging as well, because obviously what we had to do was not just go back and say, oh, it's all right, or it's changed, or changed. We actually say, well, we've got to add some value here. You know, we've got to make it something novel. It did actually take us quite a while to come up with it. I'm just trying to remember when we started. I know we certainly had at least one meeting at the Academy in August 2012, but we must also have had one in 2011 as well, I think. I'm trying to recall now. Because obviously all four of us were in different places. I mean, Igor's in the UK, but we're not in the same institution, and Bob and Mike were in the States, but they weren't in the same institution. So it was quite a challenge to brainstorm it.
Yeah. We're no stranger to that.
Yes.
Certainly. Well, I was for the final one. I was curious that you made some predictions in 2005 that you reflected on in 2013 and in between. Do you have any predictions, prophecies, indications of what might come to be in another 10 years or so?
Well, after all the events of 2016 and going into 2017, I mean, I think Armageddon is probably the best prediction.
A lot of uncertainty.
Yeah. No, then people will not listen to the podcast.
No, Armageddon later, right? Not now.
That's right. No, I think in the sense that also throws things up in the air, in the sense of, you know, there aren't these linear developments. So some of these are going in different directions. The whole kind of nationalist movements, which are pushing away from kind of the whole, you know, what you call the Washington consensus and moving towards liberal market economies. And I think that brings in a whole new dimension. So the whole kind of political dimension of management has probably grown a lot more over the last few years than when we were talking about it. You know, there's been the AMP symposium, wasn't there, about 3 years ago, 4 years ago, on the politics and management. So I think all those kind of dimensions of politics are becoming a lot more important. You know, how protectionism and reconfiguration of country groupings is going to change, I think, over the next few years.
Right. Well, then let's look forward to more institutional theory.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Mike.
Yeah, pleasure. Thanks for the opportunity. Interesting chat.
And that's it for episode 23, first episode of season 3 that we have in collaboration with the Journal of Management Studies. And we hope you enjoyed our discussion with Mike Wright of Imperial College London. It's been really interesting and a very different topic from what we usually have, which is very exciting, of course. Next week, we have a summary, but the next episode, we are bringing you a discussion with William Starbuck on his classic from the JMS, which you can find out all about by going to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. If you're enjoying the podcast, please tell your friends and colleagues, share this with your students, and maybe if you get a moment, go and leave us a review on iTunes to help new people find us. That's always very helpful. So thank you for listening, and we hope to see you next time here on Talking About Organizations.